Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Right. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Have we ever said goodbye?
No. I wonder, was that the sort of hysterical laughter of despair?
Yeah. How long? I mean, the tour's been nearly 12 weeks now, hasn't it? So it's
nearly 12 weeks. Yeah. But we're near the end. Although you mustn't start. You mustn't think like that.
No, you mustn't.
Because that's an effect.
Yeah, we're still on top four.
Yeah.
You know, the gigs are getting better. The shows are fantastic. It's, you know,
No, the gigs have always been perfect. They've always been perfect. Don't say that, because then people who saw it in the beginning would think, well, hang on a minute. What did I see?
Oh, that's true. But that is true. But you and I know that the little things that really,
yes,
you know, grow as a tour goes on are getting stronger.
That's true.
We are in Barcelona today. We, after a long drive down from Germany, where we've spent
about a thousand miles we drove.
Yeah, where we spent the last week. And now we're in the very hot Spanish city of Barcelona. And it's going to be Madrid coming up in a couple of days, Portugal, and then back home.
And then home, yeah. So there it is. But today we have a fantastic, I mean, incredibly... God, if you want to feel like you've been lazy in your life, just look at this guy's career. Amazing polymath and everything, really.
Polymath was the word I was after, because Nitin Sawhney is just good at everything, isn't he? I mean, he's a CBE. He's won 20 international awards, an Ivor Novello Lifetime Achievement Award. He makes his own solo albums, which are incredible eclectic mix of different world music. I know he doesn't like that term, world music, but music from different cultures combining together in a sort of electronica, really, at times. And he works in theatre.
Well,
and
also,
dance.
But then everything from like classical to Indian classical, everything. But yeah, then as innumerable film and TV scores as well, and even music for games, and a lot of teaching, and a lot of being artist in residence at places.
Curator. What on earth is he doing talking to us?
Well, that's fine. Yeah, it probably won't last longer.
But let me just.
Oh, he's also my band. He was my bandmate very briefly.
Yeah, played in Pink Floyd.
Played in Pink Floyd. Yeah.
Just the.
This is funny because it's the only time I've ever been sort of noted as a member of Pink Floyd. So he's actually been in Pink Floyd for as long as I have.
For the new single, which was for Ukraine. But also he's worked with Paul McCartney. He's worked with Sting, Jeff Beck, Annie Lennox. And Nelson Mandela. He's got some great stories.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Nitin.
How are you doing? You all right?
Are we going to see you?
Oh, hang on. You were in a second. I look like this.
Ah.
Oh, is that your studio?
It is indeed. That's Harry, who engineers with me every day as well. Yeah, we're in Brixton at the Dairy.
So nice.
Oh, yeah, So I've been here about 14 years or something now. Quite a long time.
So the Dairy, what is it? So I'm presuming that's a converted dairy.
I think so. I mean, I presume so as well. I've never really checked. But yeah, it was. It's been here for a long time as a studio. Lots of Guy Garvey from Elbows next door.
And, oh, right.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of... there's a few.
Oh, can you tell him we want to talk to him?
Oh yeah, well, yeah, 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 for sure. Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's a good mate as well. He's a lovely guy.
He's a so, lovely guy,
yeah,
Guy
yeah, indeed.
We're in Barcelona. We're still on tour. We've been on tour for a long time, it seems.
Yeah, I've been watching you, you know, on Instagram. You look like you're having a ball. Actually, it looks really good.
We are, but it's hard and it's long, you know.
Right,
this in this offshoot of our band, Nitin, obviously, because you and I are bandmates.
Yeah. So you know what it's like, Nitin, when you're away from home. It can be a little bit tiring. But we, fortunately, all get on. There's none of that band rift or separate camps or any of that. There's a real family spirit here, and we're all of like mind.
So important. Yeah, that's very important. I mean, I realised that many years ago that it's. I mean, in terms of touring... you know, I mean, hopefully you get the best musicians as well, but I mean, it's really important that you all get on and that you gel as a group of people, and that you have empathy with each other and know how to be around each other, you know. And it's always a journey. But I mean, recently with the band I've been touring with this year, it's just been an absolute joy. We just really all get on and have a lot of fun together, which is great.
Who's in the band?
And you tend to have your musicians. Yeah, who's in? Because your musicians tend to be all from very different backgrounds, don't they?
Yeah,
which is fantastic.
Which I really like. I mean, it's but I've had quite a few incarnations over the years, but I've stayed with certain people. I mean, like Arif Dervish has been playing tabla with me for 30 odd years now. In fact, I saw him yesterday evening as well. He came over to my place and we had a drink together. But yeah, you know, it's really nice. I mean, all of the musicians have always been have been amazing. I mean, I've been blessed with incredible players, but also really good human beings who I think are on the same page as me in terms of our ways of looking at the world.
Yeah, I mean, while we're on this subject, because the ones who really stand out for me, I mean, Ashwin's, please pronounce it, Srinivasan, right?
Srinivasan, yeah, you know, Srinivasan.
Beautiful Indian flute. But Nicky Wells, incredible vocalist, who can mix all different cultures into her voice. I mean, that's what's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many great musicians. I mean, Ashwin, I met him, I think it was in 2002 or something. I was working at a film school in India, and I met him then and thought, oh, my God, this guy is extraordinary. But he's also he's a brilliant singer. He's a brilliant flautist. I mean, he plays the bansuri, which is a bamboo version of the flute. And but the thing that's different to the concert flute is that you can bend the notes. So he's got an incredible what we call in India meend. So it's actually when you're bending the notes and moving them around and having these kind of all the tonality between notes, you know, can kind of be played with. And so as a result, there's a really fluid, beautiful, graceful way in which he works. And Nicky Wells also can do that. I mean, she spent time in India. She was in a place called Dharamshala where she studied a lot of singing techniques and so on, and she's very versatile. I haven't worked with her for quite a while because she's doing her own stuff now. She's got her own album. I think she's got a new album coming out soon. But she's but now the singers I'm working with at the moment, there's Shapla Salik, who's an incredible singer that I've been touring with, and Eva, who's fantastic. Ashwin plays with us, so yeah, it's I'm very blessed with amazing, amazing musicians.
I hope you don't mind. This might be a bit of a tangent, but I was just thinking, because there is that thing of the bending of notes and microtones is very, very priced into Indian music.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, do you think there's a kind of link between that and the blues?
Exactly what I was going to ask. That's what to me. You know?
Well, that's why we're the rock on top. Yeah.
Well, the thing... Well, actually, it's very interesting, all of that, because there is a certain rock. So the way in which Indian classical music works is there's lots of rules around it, but with the rag system, it's kind of, which is kind of like a more complex way of thinking about modality. For example, you have ways of thinking about the scales in descending and ascending ways, which are a bit like a melodic minor in a way, if you simplify it, in that you have the scale is different ascending and descending, but also you have a lot of rules in terms of what you can play next when you are playing around with the rag. Now, rag in itself means colour, and it's kind of, it's based around moods and different times of day and the seasons. So you have 72 kind of main rags in Hindustani music, which is North
72?
Indian classical. Yeah. But also, but they come from 10 thaats, which are, again, like the modes, the main kind of basis. So there's lots of ways, but then also you have the thal system, which is a very complex system of time signatures. So you have, common time signatures in Indian classical music are like 10-beat cycles, which is known as japtal, or you'll have ekdal, which is 12-beat cycles, as well as 16-beat cycles, stintal. So you have a lot of these, and they're very mathematical, the way in which they work. So there is a lot to it. But when you were talking about the blues, I mean, there is a particular rag called rag malkonce, which actually is a pentatonic scale, which actually has a lot of similarity, if you listen to it, to the blues, in the same way that if you listen to rag Kirvani, which is like a harmonic minor, you can kind of hear it. Sometimes sounds a bit like Bach when people are playing it because of that kind of flavor. So it's interesting, all these different ways when you focus on certain notes within a rag, then certain flavors come out.
But that connection with the blues, if you like, with the bending of notes, it offers up a yearning into instrumental music that really feels like a connection with desire and need that blues has, that those bending of notes in Indian music has, that even in some Eastern European music, which can often come out in, I know you've got this fantastic violinist that you play with, Anna Phoebe, that
oh yeah, sort of, God, yeah,
that Jewish klezmer style of bending as well. There is a connection with that classical music and the English classical, British classical music and European classical music doesn't contain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating with all of that, because with the bending of notes, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's you hear this in lots of different cultures, and Celtic music has that as well. But it's kind of, it's a different flavor. I mean, with Middle Eastern music, for example, the way in which the notes bend is different. And even within classical music, what is known as glissando or portamento within classical music is actually quite different in terms of how you play that bend. So, for example, when I was working at the BBC Proms years ago, I brought in some string players from India, Carnatic violinists, to show
that Indian string swoop thing is amazing.
To show them how to play a glissando in a more Indian accent, almost. So it's kind of it does differ. But I mean, I think it's it's fascinating, because you're right when you say that, Gary. When you talk about the idea of a yearning quality, there's this idea within the Indian rag system of always kind of yearning, not only for the sa. When I say sa, you have sarigamapada nisa, which are the actual the degrees of the scale. So do re mi fa sol la ti do. So it's kind of the same thing. But if you take that, you have the kind of, you always have this yearning to get to the root, in the same way as you do if you're moving around in jazz and you're moving between 2-5-1s. You always have all mm-hmm. cadences. I mean, there's always this idea of trying to get back to the sa. But also mathematically as well, with doubler players, they're always trying to get to the one, to the first beat of the cycle. So there's a yearning quality there as well. So, for example, you'll have this, you'll have, if I clapped it out for you now, if you have a 10-beat cycle, which is known as japtal, so you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So if you have that going on, you can have mathematical patterns like which will repeat three times, landing on the one. So So you're hitting the one there on the test. So that's the 11th beat or the first beat of the falling cycle.
You know what? I just wanted to jump in here, because the connection is. I think is useful, in that you're talking about that kind of music wanting to always yearn to get to the root or to home, right?
Yes, or to the one, to the first beat.
But I see a segue here.
But there is, because you're, fascination, obviously, with and your new album, Immigrants, you know, with travel, with not being at home, with maybe that yearning. Is there a connection there that you can make musically?
Definitely. I mean, and in fact, I think I made that connection most on a track called Homelands. And I talk about that track. Right, yeah. I mean, that was on an album I did a long time ago, back in the 90s, late 90s, called Beyond Skin. And on that, there is a... And in fact, we performed it at the Royal Albert Hall, you know, many times. But it's but my favourite time, I think... Or my last two performances there were my favourite, where we actually had a choir.
Amazing.
And it's also but what's really lovely about that is that I kind of brought in lots of different flavors. Like, I'm a flamenco guitarist, so I brought in some flamenco kind of flavors, and also Brazilian flavors in Portuguese, and also there are Cavalli
the choral
flavors,
stuff, you know. Again, has that almost Bulgarian Eastern European feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I love that as well. I think that's amazing. And I love the way in which they move around notes. You know, when they're singing, this idea of constantly moving around the root or the harmonies, so it's never quite settled. I love that because it gives this quality of impermanence and this feeling of being constantly up in the air and having an expectation. So it kind of, it makes you so much more interested. There's a lot more texture to the music for me when things aren't so clean and so kind of like, okay, here's the final chord before you've actually had time to kind of have a sense of playing with it, I guess.
There's a great old quote from Yusu Ndour, which I think applies to you. And this was back in the 80s. I remember him saying this. It always stuck with me. He said, modern music doesn't have roots. It has aerials.
Okay. Yeah. That's very... I like that a lot. I mean, yeah. It's... Well, I mean, it's interesting in a way because I always think about... I mean, I'd never try to bring things together because what I think of is... I think that you have... Music for me is like you have a palette and you're trying to paint emotional pictures in a way through sound. And so it's kind of like, in a way, I look at the whole world as my palette, you know, musically. But I don't try to contrive. I mean, that would be to focus on the form as opposed to what you want to say. So I kind of think, what is it you have to say in the first place? What's the idea? What is it you want to get across? And then you find the musical palette to go with that. And then you kind of, and then it just emerges, you know, it's... because I believe in that idea as well. It's interesting what you were saying, because John Coltrane talked about the idea that improvisation is like a bird that you catch in the air. And there's, you know, there's other people like Panditji Ravi Shankar who talked about the idea of being a medium to channel the music that is all around us. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of discovery and uncovering music that is actually already there. I mean, Gary, when you solo, you know, you're not thinking about every note. You know, when I've seen you play some beautiful guitar solos and you know, you're actually playing in such a way that you are connecting, you're communing with something, you know, and I do believe that when I play, when you improvise and you know, both of you, I mean, you know, as musicians, that there is something that is also taking over, because you're not in your head anymore, you're in a feeling. Yeah. And that, where's that feeling coming from? It's coming from you, but you're also, like you said, like an aerial, and you pick up everything. Mm-hmm. You're picking up channels of possibility.
The whole of Western music has been driven by immigration. You know, if you think about the Broadway musical, that sound of those chord sequences, and you know, that's an Eastern European music. We're talking about blues and rock music. We're talking about slavery and African immigration, and it's not something that, oh, you know, Peter Gabriel invented this idea, or Eno invented this idea. This has been the root of all popular music, this co-joining.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I mean, you know, like in terms of blues, I mean, what was fantastic was when you had someone like Ali Farkaturi getting together with Ry Cooder.
And
it's like, you know, I love that because Ali Farkaturi, you know, it's like hearing Malian players, or Beseku Koyati, who's an incredible Ngoni player, who came here years ago and we had a great jam, and you know, or playing with Umu Sangare, a lot of those Malian musicians, you hear that blues which is in their playing. It's just intrinsic to the way they are, and it fascinates me because, you know, blues and jazz and so on, they've gone through the American Revolution, and, you know, in terms of, and I mean musical revolution, you know, in terms of how music has kind of really, you know, gone through so many changes and transitions in America. I mean, the jazz scene in America has been incredible, and, you know, but you kind of look at those roots, and they are from many different cultures. They're from many different traditions, and I think it's very important to keep that perspective, because we can kind of just get locked into associating music with nationality in the same way that sometimes we do that with politics and with everything else.
Yeah, well, when I met you on the day we did Hey Hey Rise Up, I remember one of the first things I said was I'd recently heard your Desert Island Discs, and I thanked you for reminding me of Shakti.
Oh yeah! Instance, oh my God!
Which I'd forgotten, you know,
John McLaughlin,
the 70s, which was the,
yeah.
John McLaughlin, but it was a fusion of, you know, like sort of jazz a music that was already fusion, then being fused with Indian music.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're incredible. I mean, that band as well, I mean, you know, with Zaki Hussain, who's just an incredible, legendary double player, but also El Shankar on violin, Carnatic violin, but, you know, Viku on clay pot. I mean, incredible musicians. But what was one of my greatest privileges and probably one of my most humbling moments was actually being on stage earlier this year with John McLaughlin when I was working with Anushka Shankar, and we played a gig at the Royal Festival Hall. Yeah, the Royal Festival Hall. Mm-hmm. And that was really, really enjoyable. But I
what
mean
did
to
you
meet
play?
Him.
What did you, play?
I play, I play guitar, and I had it, I kind of was hiding. No, it was, but yeah, you got someone like him.
If I was on a stage with John McLaughlin, I'd head for the piano.
Yeah, I know, I was like, yeah, well, I wasn't, that was the thing. I was thinking, I presume I'm playing the piano. And they said, no, we're not using a grand piano there. I was like, oh no, you mean I've actually got to play guitar with John McLaughlin there? It's like, but which he was actually very complimentary about it. There was a piece that we played of mine called River Pulse, which I played, and he came up to me, said, that's a really lovely piece of music. I was like, oh my God, I just got complimented like a bunch of uncle. But it's like,
how do you feel between the instruments, by the way? Between, you know, is one of them your home, the piano or the guitar? Or
you know what, my home is more in terms of feelings and thoughts, and then music just comes from that. So I kind of think that sounds a bit pretentious in a way, but I mean, it's kind of, but I think for me, you know, I was a classical pianist first from the age of five, and that's what I trained in. But I then got into flamenco, and I used to play in a Van Halen covers band, which is quite fun when I was younger. And so I used to play all the tapping and do all that.
I
could do all that. Yeah, I could shred. I could still play Eruption, actually. I did that a few years ago in this studio. I could show you. But no, it's kind of, it makes me laugh because all of that, you know, I used to do. Quite young, I used to kind of, you know, but it was kind of like I had that time, and I'd also play, I'd try and play along with Aldi Mela and Paco and John McLaughlin. I'd try and play a lot of those things, but I mean, but John McLaughlin's power and speed and inspiration with his playing was just insane. So, but you know, incredible.
But
incredible
this your skills of flamenco and your skills on the piano, I mean, is this something you're constantly practicing, studying? Did you start?
Not enough anymore.
But did you? Are you, yeah. Is it all self-taught?
No. I did the grades when I was very young.
So you did the grades. You started, and was that a love of classical music or just?
Oh yeah, yeah, totally, totally loved it. Yeah, particularly the French. I mean, the French Romantics, more Debussy, Ravel, Sarti. They were the people who really moved me. But then for the pyrotechnics and the kind of, you know, I used to play Fantasy Impromptu and Chopin and all of that. And then third movement of Moonlight Sonata. These are the kind of things that get your hands moving. And also I used to.
It's the eruption of classical music.
Well, there you go. But also playing Bach 2-part inventions and all of that stuff, you know, when I was very young. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I love all of that. But I guess, you know, guitar, I became totally fanatical about it. And you know, as you know, Gary, when you play lead guitar, you check out every lead guitarist going. You're always listening to lead guitarists and just thinking, oh, what are they doing there? How are they doing that? And listening for different techniques. And it's a you know, it's you kind of totally fall in love with the instrument because of the things that you can do. You know, playing flamenco, you use every aspect of the guitar. You're whacking it with your fingers. You have all the you have all the different ways of playing. You know, getting rolls with your hands and getting and getting all kinds of techniques together, which are you know, strumming techniques with your fingers. All of that is kind of part of really enjoying, you know, the whole instrument as opposed to just being locked into one thing.
How did you? Because you seem to have a Brazilian thing going on as well as the flamenco.
Well, that's because I think I love Brazilian. You know, I loved bossa nova when I was young. You know, like the Tony Jobim. You know, all of that stuff. I loved it because again, it's beautiful guitar chords and really lovely techniques, which really work well with you know, the way in which you know, the bossa nova singers. You know, I love all that production. It's gorgeous.
How did you learn these stuff as a kid? Were you doing piano lessons and flamenco lessons at the same time?
Yeah, at one point I was doing that, but I think, you know, at the same time my dad had an incredibly eclectic you know, kind of record collection. My brothers were listening to Zeppelin and the Doors and all of that stuff, and Pink Floyd, obviously. I was also kind of, you know, listening to a lot of Cuban music through my dad, who listened also to all the crooners. He was into Nat King Cole, so I'd listen to Nat King Cole Trio and all of that, which always blew me away with the, I think, one of the most underrated pianists of all time, Nat King Cole, absolutely brilliant pianist. And, you know,
but there was an interview you did about where you talked about this, like an encounter with racism, but for me there's also an interesting point about the music. You said how a music teacher came in to a room at school and you were playing a piece of Indian classical music, and he said, where's the music,
where's the sheet music?
He said,
there
isn't any. So he said that, well, that doesn't count.
So
you can't play that in here, which is an awful
yeah
form, so.
Yeah,
in terms of racism. But I'm also fascinated by the fact that you're saying that Indian classical music, is there no notation at all?
Well, originally it was an oral tradition, but yes, it is notated now. You know, there is.
But I mean, there's no native Indian notation for it.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
There is.
There's,
okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Right. Like what you've been describing earlier, it's so complicated.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is. I mean, it's like with what I was talking about with Sarigama Padanisar, those are called sargams. You write them down and you'll have different ways of notating whether it's sharp or flat or on the note, and then the duration of the note. There are different ways of doing it.
Right.
It looks like Pittman's shorthand if you look at it, but it's kind of, but it is really, it's a really beautiful way of notating, but really it comes from an oral thing. And it's the same with the tabla techniques. You know, for example, what I was speaking earlier is one particular, you know, way of thinking about a pattern within a cycle, but that can be used in Indian classical dance as well as Indian class. So there is a great communication not only between musicians but also between forms. Like, for example, a Kathak dancer, which is an Indian classical dancer, North Indian classical, they'll be able to communicate very clearly with the tabla player, with the percussionist, what they're thinking, what their footwork is going to do, and that's kind of a forerunner to the connection between flamenco guitarists and flamenco dancers as well,
because they have their teacher there, don't they, sort of shouting and egging them on. And
yeah, absolutely.
This is why obviously you've been able to approach writing music for ballet, I guess, and for other dance forms.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting all of that, because with Stravinsky, with Rite of Spring, he had very complex time signature kind of, or he was played with time in very interesting ways, or his own way. And
ballet, isn't it? I mean,
that's right. And he got very angry. He got very angry with the ballet dancers because he didn't think they were getting quite right. And
Nijinsky.
You wouldn't have that same issue with the Kathak dancers, with the tabla players, because they're equally informed. And so that's what I mean. So they will understand each other's language, and that's a kind of different type of thing. But yeah, I love working with ballet and classical. I mean, I worked a lot with contemporary dance, mainly with Akram, but I'm actually about to work with a ballet dancer who's actually from India, trained in ballet, but he's bringing in his own kind of heritage, and he's the son of a rickshaw driver, and he's been training with ballet for many years, and I think Sadler's Wells are going to kind of be doing some work with him as well.
What about electronica? Because that obviously came into your life. There was a sort of, you know, I guess in the 90s, there was what, you know, gets called the sort of Asian underground scene. Mm, but, mm. You know, as though it was a separate entity. Was it? What role were you in that?
So I kind of always, I had a mixed relationship with it, you know, love-hate relationship in a way, because, I mean, when that term came out, I mean, I always said you can't really reduce cultural change to a fad or a fashion. I mean, this is about change in terms of how we look at society and look at embracing diversity and pluralism, you know. So when you have, you know, these terms, I kind of found it like, well, Asian underground, what is that? Actually, it's about a lot of young Asian musicians and artists trying to be heard and you know, trying to get, and they shouldn't really be underground. They should
be. Well, that's the issue, isn't it? Because that in itself said, right, you're not in the norm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, wasn't there a thing that you said you'd call up record companies and they just hear your name and they go, we're not signing any Bangra?
Yeah exactly. That and then that did happen, yeah. And I was like, oh my god, you know. But it's kind of my whole thing is that you know, that time was a really interesting time. In a way, it was kind of almost like a renaissance of young Asian artists in the UK, and I think there was a lot of amazing club music that came out of that. I mean, I used to DJ as well, and I used to DJ at Fabric, and I DJed in the 90s more at Ormond's and The End and places like that, and the Face used to come down lots of you know, it became very fashionable to kind of come down. Goldie used to come down, Bjork came down, you know, a lot of interesting cool people used to turn up at these clubs, and we'd play a lot of music that featured Indian classical music and blended it with electronica. And when I say that, we were kind of, you know, bringing in drum and bass influences mainly, but also kind of like different types of electronic flavors.
So were you making this music though?
Yeah. So I got into programming in a big way. I mean, back then, initially, I didn't really work with a computer. I was working with keyboards more that you could program and then hook them up to samplers like the, you know, the Akai sampler, or you'd hook them up to
the Akai.
Yeah, I know, this was the thing.
I get PTSD flashbacks from remembering programming those.
That's right. And people were using the Atari kind of you'd get C-Lab and Creator and Notator, all that stuff. So, but what happened, Cubase? But what happened was over time, everything started to evolve. And then I got into using Logic and stuff like that more, and then using analog gear in different ways. So it's kind of, yeah, I've always been programming for a long time, and I love doing that. And actually producing Jules Holland's album recently, I found myself kind of, you know, because we were coming out of lockdown, or we were still in lockdown, I was using certain techniques at times in terms of programming to bridge the gaps where we couldn't get live players, you know, to make it feel organic. And there are ways of doing that.
This is interesting.
He's not in a room with a big band for Jules. It's not.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, but what I'm saying is at times it was difficult to get everyone back in again or whatever. It got quite tricky, but having said that, you know, it came out really well.
When someone like Jules rings you up and says, I'd really like you to produce my album, are you thinking, he wants me to bring certain, let's just say, Asian styles and things and eclectic things to the table? Or are you more flexible than that?
Yeah. I mean, I mean, for example, I wrote Lang Lang's part for him to duet with, you know, because I have a classical background more, you know, then he'd written one part and I said, well, I can write that up for you and you know, we can send it to Lang Lang as a part. So I kind of wrote that up, and I mean, I worked a lot with classical musicians like Helene Grimaud, who plays with Daniel Barenboim. Yeah, so I've worked, I produced a couple of her albums and worked with her, and she covered one of my tracks amazingly. But I obviously had to write that up in a way that I knew would work with her technique, because I'm a classical player, I kind of wrote it up in a way that was going to work, you know.
Water. Is that a nice thing for you to do, to make yourself disappear? Do you know what I mean? Rather than it rather than you making the statement? Is it a nice thing to vanish and just have?
Yeah, definitely. I like that. I mean, you know, I'm not really. I mean, having said that, I'm about to do. I've do one man shows every now and then, and I used to do comedy with Sanjeev Bhaskar.
I want to talk to you about that.
Yeah. Okay. Can you just give me 2 minutes? Because I had breakfast and I just need a wee.
Go for it.
I'll start the comedy because because there's such a link between these. I find it so fascinating. You started as a comedian because I do comedy. I've done a one man show for about 15 years, and I was always really embraced by that community. Because most of them, they either love music or were musicians.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, like Sanjeev.
Or wanted to be musicians.
Yeah, Sanjeev's a musician, you know, as well. And, you know, he's great. I mean, I didn't start, as a comedian, but I did comedy.
But you, the first sort of commercial professional venture you did was with Sanjeev, wasn't it?
No. I had already released albums and stuff.
I've researched all I can.
No. But what it was we went to college together and we used to kind of do review shows.
Was this in Liverpool?
No, so I studied law at Liverpool University, then, for my sins, I studied accountancy. I qualified as an accountant of all things, and that's where I met Sanj because he was doing business studies. But he's always been a really good mate, and we just did that. Literally for me, it was just having a laugh with some friends, and I didn't realise it was going to get so big. It just kind of. It's been weird that way, you know. I kind of my best mate at school was James Taylor from James Taylor Quartet, and so we used to kind of hang out together, and then you know next thing I'm kind of playing with him, and we used to tour together, and so I've been really blessed with lots of people I've known over the years who have actually gone on to be really successful musicians or artists or whatever, and I've known them, you know, before all of that kicked off, which is really nice because it's kind of I've seen them through that, you know, progress through that success, which has been great.
I know what you mean. I mean, just a few weeks ago we had Youth on the show.
Oh yeah. He's great.
Who I literally started playing music with at school.
Oh really? Oh wow.
Yeah. So that was, you know.
Oh, he's brilliant. I love Youth. I mean, he's a really nice guy as well, isn't he? He's great. Yeah. I mean, he's incredibly. I mean, like, he asked me to DJ years ago at his house party, when I put out Beyond Skin. Yeah. So I was there in the back garden, and he had some people coming around talking about all kinds of stuff to do with the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, this book that had come out at the time. And it was, I think it was around the time that he was doing stuff with The Verve. And he said, I want you to DJ, but I just want you to play your album, Beyond Skin. I said, you want me to DJ my own album for the whole of the time? He said, yeah. I said, I might look a bit narcissistic if I do that. And he said, no, that's what I want you to do. I went, right, so all these people come up and say, what's this then? I'd say, yeah, this is me as well. It's like,
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the rock on tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out.
Beyond Skin, obviously, 1999, you know, that came out. You'd already done a few albums before then, but that really changed your life, that album. I mean, suddenly I would imagine your parents went, thank God, he's making some money. He's getting some recognition. I mean, just talk about that life-changing experience, because everyone knew that album.
Yeah. It's so weird to me because it was the most personal thing I'd ever done, and I took 2 years over it. I mean, but I didn't know what it was in a way. I kind of thought, well, it was kind of playing around with issues of identity, nationality, race, all kinds of things. But I was kind of, I was doing
nuclear weapons.
Yeah, the whole thing about that, and I remember going on Hard Talk and talking about this was, first of all, I mean, the whole thing about it was me using news footage or news clips as well as recording my mum and dad. So it was almost like I was making a collage or a kind of personal album, you know, a kind of personal expression that was, and in some ways, I didn't really care what people thought about it. I just needed to make it. And so my mum and dad are on there talking, but also it starts off with the Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee of that time talking very proudly about how he tested 3 nuclear bombs in the Pokhran Range in India. And then I bookended that with Oppenheimer, who was obviously in charge of the Manhattan Project with the nuclear testing. And he condemns his own creation in the name of Hinduism. And there you've got the Hindu fundamentalist prime minister of that time saying, isn't it great we got nuclear bombs? And then you've got
What you've said could be misconstrued. He didn't do it in the name of Hinduism. He did it using a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, isn't it? Isn't that...
What I'm saying is that Vajpayee was actually the Hindu fundamentalist leader.
I just meant your wording,
the condemnation was from Oppenheimer in the name of Hinduism.
He wasn't condemning it in the name of Hinduism. Quote from the Bhagavad
Gita. Yes, it was from the Bhagavad Gita. So what he said was, he said, I feel like I'm... No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, not in the name of Hinduism. Yeah, that's correct. But what he did was he said, I feel like I'm become like Vishnu, the destroyer of worlds. But what was interesting about that is that he's quoting the Bhagavad Gita, but in a very emotional way and condemning it, is what I'm saying. But he's using Hinduism to do that. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Not in the name of. But what I liked about all of that was it kind of exposed for me the fact that identity isn't necessarily synonymous with nationality or religion, because there you've got an American scientist who's talking about Hinduism to condemn his own creation of the nuclear bomb, and then you've got Vajpayee, who's supposedly the Hindu fundamentalist guy, who's actually saying, here I am, very proud of it. And I kind of thought that was an interesting contradiction or paradox, and I liked that, because we all know obviously Pink Floyd, and you know, I loved the fact, and I was hugely influenced by the way in which they would, you know, those concept albums. I loved all of that. That for me, when you had a great concept, I mean, for me, it was just about connecting with narrative and stories and ideas, you know, and you know, I mean, lyrically, I mean, I always found it amazing to create journeys and to find different ways of expressing ideas. And really, what I wanted to do was create a musical narrative or kind of fit sense of journey through an album, really.
Did those ideas inform the music from the start? Did they come first and then you sat down and consciously wrote every single chapter of that idea?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, because what I wanted to do was I had in my head this idea of trying to express certain things, so I did divide it up into sections, you know, like I talked about the album in relation to in relation to separation themes, and there were certain themes that emerge in certain sections of the album, and a sense of longing, and then a sense of unity, and then a sense of belonging as well, and acceptance as well. So there were lots of different themes in there that I was kind of playing with that I wanted to explore, and I find that for me is the best way, because otherwise, with the way I think, I can go a lot of different directions musically, and there's nothing to anchor things on. So I like to find, you know, like Massive Attack were a huge influence that way. You know, if I listen to albums like Protection or Mezzanine, there's an incredible mood and power and atmosphere through the whole thing, which is difficult to put your finger on, but it's very strong. But I can't say that those songs are connected in any way musically necessarily. They're quite diverse.
There is a sort of certain amount of didactic quality to, say, an album like Immigrants that's just come out, where you're trying to inform your listener, I feel, in a good way, about the issues that are on your mind. The slight difficulty nowadays is because books don't come, streaming doesn't come with lyrics, and often you use multiple languages and different languages and on your music. Does that shroud too much the ideas that you're trying to get across?
So what I try to do actually is stay away from being didactic in one way, in that I don't try to tell anyone what to think. I try to be cathartic with the music. So if I'm working with certain artists, we'll kind of talk thematically about what we want to say, and what we feel passionately about, and then what will emerge might be something that is around a subject that we feel passionately about. For example, working with Ayanna Whittier-Johnson, who's also on Jules' album as well, you know, we were talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, and then this track just came out of all of that. But again, it's kind of her expressing her own experiences and feelings, and we want to keep it so it felt personal and emotional and human. But I think that's the thing. It's a tricky thing, because if you are dealing with universal issues, or if you even live in a politicized context as we do now, you know, I kind of think almost everything you do is a political statement. You know, I mean, it's like
everything is art, everything is politics.
Yeah,
it's my favorite badge ever.
Exactly. And I totally think that, because, you know, everything is so politicized. It's polarized. The world is kind of, you know, it's become politicized. So everything you say, if you ignore that, that's a political statement. If you kind of engage with it, it's, you know, so whatever you do. So from that point of view, I kind of just think, well, where do I stand on certain things? What do I feel about, strongly about? And then that's where things come from. With a lot of people, it might be relationships or love. For me, it's actually about how I communicate or how I feel with the world.
And is it, because it is a thing that always runs through a lot of your work, is it, you know, growing up as the child of immigrants, is it a feel of always trying to find what is your actual home, you know, this being your home and a sense of otherness, or, you know?
I think that's something I realised over time, because it's like, I don't think I realised that was what I was struggling with until I got to Beyond Skin, really. Because that was, you know, for me, and the fact that I just intuitively wanted to interview my parents about their experiences and so on and put that on an album, I just didn't question it. I didn't have any reference for anyone who'd done that before. It was just something I really wanted to do to connect it with my music. And it's kind of like, it is a sense of always trying to think about where is your home, because ultimately, you know, I believe that your home is, you know, to be cliched, it's where your heart is, but it's kind of like ultimately where you feel most passionate, where you feel most connected, where you feel most empathic, you know, and I think that can be anywhere. You know, I feel now, I think as an older person, as we get older, I think we relax into ourselves and our identity more over time. And I think it's possible to feel at home anywhere. I mean, when you're on tour, you know, guys, I mean, it's like, you know, when you're traveling around, you know, everywhere becomes your home, you know, but you have to be relaxed in yourself for that to be the case. Because, I mean, otherwise you can feel really insecure with unfamiliarity. And I think it's about being secure in every situation. And that's an internal work that you have to do on yourself, I think.
What I think our listeners would also like to know is all the famous people you've worked with and who you've met. I mean, you
Guy.
Know, I love, I mean, we're going to have to talk about Paul McCartney. We're going to have to talk about you meeting Nelson Mandela, because I'm sure your parents weren't thinking, well, we really want him to have a career in pop music. You end up meeting Nelson Mandela on this journey, not long after Beyond Skin, I think, isn't it?
Yes, right. It was in 2001. And I mean, I was very fortunate to actually meet him in his home, you know, to be invited over to his house. And literally, I mean, I'd as I said, you know, in many times before, I was literally finishing the last page of his book, Long Walk to Freedom, in his garden, which is quite crazy. So I just literally...
I better finish this before I meet him.
Yeah, well, it was a bit like that. I was like, oh my God, I need to get to the end. And but I did. And it was, I think the last phrase is, we are free to be free. And that phrase ended up on the track Breathing Light, which I put on the album. But it was more, I wanted to just... The thing about that journey that I went on was more about engaging with kind of people that I wanted to know more about and understand, you know, from direct experience. So he was one of those people. I mean, Aboriginal people, you know, where I spent time with them in Arnhem Land, it was amongst them as well that I discovered a lot. And then also spending time with Native Americans, kids in street shelters in Brazil, all kinds of things.
Were you filming this? Were you filming?
Some of it, yes, yeah, we did film quite a bit of it. But it was incredible to meet. But meeting Nelson Mandela, I mean, I was just blown away by his humility, by his openness, by his humour, by his ability to switch between being very, very chilled and funny and kind of almost like someone you'd kind of just meet, you know, anywhere, to being this incredible statesman. You know, when I started to interview him, and we switched on a recording device, which was a DAT machine, I think, at the time, he suddenly changed in a totally understandable way. And the questions I was asking him, he was very formal about that until... And I've talked about this many times, which is one of the most amazing things, was when his PA came into the room and said, Madiba, which is what they called him, the president's on the phone to speak to you. You know, he wants to talk to you now. And Mandela turned around and just said, how many more questions have you got to me? And I said, two or three. And he just goes, could you ask him to call back in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Now, the thing that blew me away about that, I kid you not, I nearly cried in that moment. I'll tell you why. Is because I'd read in that book about his speech at Riviona, where he said, I stand for the struggle of all people, not just black South Africans. And I thought, yeah, you know what? This is what politicians say. They say all this stuff about, and it sounds great, you know, but no one's a real egalitarian. No one really walks the walk of being a true egalitarian. People talk about it, but are they really? That was the moment where I thought, oh my God, the guy actually is. He actually is the real deal. Mm-hmm. This guy I'm looking at right now sees me, I'm choking up as I say it, sees me, some, you know, arsehole from London, you know, in the same way as he sees a president. He doesn't distinguish. He's just going, I'm talking to this guy now. That's the person I'm talking to. I don't care, you know, for, you know, whoever. It's like that's, and that for me was what moved me in that moment. And it's kind of, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I literally couldn't get words out for a bit because I was like, wow, I never thought I'd meet anyone like that, you know, and somebody who's been through so much. There's no one in my life who I've ever come across who's seen so much of oppression and power in one lifetime. A guy spent 27 years in jail, 19 of which were in solitary confinement, and there he comes out president. So you look at that and you think, my God, he's been here and he's been here, and he's still got that humility, and that astonished me.
What about Macca? What about yeah. Macca, though? Come on.
Incredible.
You know, I love Mandela, but I love Macca too.
You know,
how was your meeting? Suddenly you're in a room. That boy is in a room with Paul McCartney. Tell us the story.
And he's continued to be, actually, and I was very privileged to have lunch with him very recently. And he stayed in touch, and we've stayed, you know, sometimes we text each other as well. He's a lovely guy. But the first time I met him was back in the 90s when... And it's funny because it's connected to youth as well, because youth was doing the Fireman project.
That's the Fireman, that's
yeah.
right.
Did, yeah. So what happened was McCartney asked me if I would do a remix for the Fireman. And so,
this is your first contact with him?
Yeah.
He just
yeah.
got in touch and said, would you do
He got in touch with my with my manager of the right. time. Yeah, then. So then I kind of said, sure. And then but having said that, at that time, I was working in my bedroom in a shared flat with Sanjeev Bhaskar and a few other people. They were like, I had a tiny kind of bedroom at that time, and as you know, money was not something I was kind of familiar with, so I was kind of in this room, and he calls me up in the morning, literally calls me up and says, I'd like to come over and see how you're working.
Is this McCartney?
So yeah I was saying, sorry, he goes, like, I'd like to come over. So, come over where? I said, he said, to your where you work. Where you? I said, no, I work in my bedroom. And he goes, yeah, I'll come over. And I was like, right. So I was like, amazing. So then I kind of go around and I'm telling everyone, like, and everyone's hoovering manically, and kind of we had like cardboard boxes all over. But it's like we were living like students. I mean, it was just a joke. And so
you need to get a mum right. You need a mum.
I needed my mum. Should have got my mum. But what happened was then he comes round in the evening. I mean, and comes up the stairs because someone let him in, and he comes up and he walks into my room, and he looks around. And there are several things that happen at once. The first thing is, in my head, I'm thinking, "Wow, I know so much about this guy I've never met before. I know about his history. I know, and he's so familiar, but I've never met him before." And that was the thing that blew me away, because I'd never met anyone as famous as that firsthand and known so much about them without ever having engaged with them. So that was the first thing that struck me. The second thing was that he said, the first words were, "Oh, I used to live in a place a bit like this." He said it was a kind of bedsit that I had, and he said, "I wrote a track called Scrambled Eggs there. I'll play it to you." And he sat down and played Yesterday and sung Yesterday on my guitar. Right. So my first in my bedroom. So the first thing I've got is, like, I'm sitting there going, okay, this is definitely pretty. it's like okay.
That's Paul trying to blow your mind, isn't it?
No, this is proof that we live in a simulation, that this is a simulated reality. Yeah, because there's no way that could happen.
It, yeah.
yeah, it's like there's no way in any reality that could happen. So I'm sitting there going, okay. You know, you got to pinch yourself several times. But I mean, obviously, that was mind-blowing, and to actually have my guitar blessed by McCartney's hands. But also big, but interesting, because, you know, I was watching him because I know he's left-handed. So it's like, so he's playing. But it's beautiful. It's just amazing to watch him play and sing. So I kind of, anyway, he hung out. We went to a local cafe for a bit, I think. And we just got, I mean, it was just amazing. He just hung out for a while as if he was anyone else. And that was the thing. I was, again.
But that's the thing, you know, yeah. Surely Paul McCartney wants to do that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but you know what's
from time to time.
But what's amazing is how good his memory is, because you meet him years later and he remembers everything. I mean, like, I you know, went to his sadly ill-fated wedding with Heather, and you know, it's interesting because the way he communicates, he remembers everything of every meeting I've had with him, and he you know, I once had. One of the incredible things was actually with David Gilmour, at McCartney's house, and David Gilmour started playing the saxophone, of all things, and I'm playing the piano, and Paul McCartney's singing, and I'm kind of thinking, okay, I'm jamming with Pink Floyd and the Beatles here. it's a bit of pressure on, but it's kind of, you know, it's amazing, because he'd been to one of my gigs at the Royal Albert Hall, and he came there. Actually, it was, I think, 4 days after George died, after George Harrison passed away, and he was there at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was just an incredible thing that he'd come that soon after. I thought he would. I was convinced he was going to cancel coming, but he still came, and that's what I mean. He's always been very supportive. He's always been very down to earth.
But how did just, you write together? You ended up doing a track together, didn't you? My Soul.
Well, this is the thing. So at when I met him at his place, he actually started playing around in the wine glass and got a sound out of a wine glass. I said, oh, that's cool. I said, what you should do on my next album is play the wine glass. I said, I'd love to just say Macca on wine glass. And he said, oh, I like that idea. So,
we know
so,
that's how the intro to Shine On You Crazy Diamond was done.
Oh, really?
It's wine glasses.
Yeah. Ah, I didn't know that. Oh, I love that. Oh, my God, it's one of my favourite tracks ever, that guitar solo.
Anyway, sorry, just,
oh, my God. That guitar solo was one of my most biggest influences. Anyway, but yeah, with... yeah, so he did that. He played, and he said, yeah, sure, that'd be great. And I was thinking, is this going to happen? So then he did. He turned up at mine, but obviously... Not to play the wine glass. He had his bass, and we wrote a track called My Soul together, and recorded that at my house then, you know, which is where I was living in Wandsworth Common. But again, he just hung out for the day and just was lovely.
How did you write together though?
Well, I just pretend I was John Lennon, but no, it was kind of. But yeah, I mean, obviously, the thing is. You will be writing as I write with anyone else and talk to... I just have conversations and then something emerges. But yes, you will have this moment where you just kind of like everything slows down and you go, I'm in the same shoes as John Lennon or whatever. You know, I'm writing with McCartney. You know, so you do have this moment where you kind of think, oh, shit. And you can't, you know, you kind of freeze for a bit. You're thinking, this is quite crazy. But yeah, I mean, having said that, it kind of, it was just, he makes you feel very relaxed and very much like, you know, he'll just talk to you as a human being. And that's the thing. Great people do that. You know, I mean, David Gilmour does that. Anyway, you know, people that you meet, you know, who are kind, secure people, you know, will talk to you in a way that actually shows empathy. And that's what you engage with is the empathy, I guess, rather than anything. Rather than, I mean, you know as well, you guys know that there are people you will meet who will come to your concerts or whatever, and you realise they're looking through you at some kind of version of you that they have in their heads because they've always loved your music or they've always whatever, which is lovely in one way, but they're not really talking to you as the real person who's standing in front of them. And at the end of the day,
you're sort of an irrelevance.
Yeah.
Who you are is an irrelevance.
Yeah, because they've had this relationship with a projected version of you that they've created in their heads through engaging with your music. Which is all good.
Which can be bad as well. There can be a very, you know, two-dimensional version of you that they
very much know. Yeah, it can be terrible.
I know, Guy, you got deep into the John Hurt album yesterday. Didn't
I wanted to. I wanted to ask you about the Last Days of Reason.
Meaning, Last Days of Meaning. Yeah.
Last Days of Meaning. That's what I said.
Yeah.
because it's these fantastically that sort of, I don't know if this is Beckettian vignettes. Almost. It's kind of redolent of Crap's Last Tape or something.
Well, I'm glad you said that because obviously, I loved Sammy Beckett and I was a big fan of the Theatre of the Absurd.
Yeah, huge fan of Beckett.
Yeah,
I think it's one of the things that drew me to it. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Also, musically, it's fantastic.
Thanks. Well,
tell us about the journey of that. I mean, well, that's just for anyone who doesn't know it, it's this beautiful album which has between some of the tracks, there's these reflections from John Hurt, who's this character in a room.
Yeah, weirdly called Donald Meaning, and if you look at the front cover of it looks a bit like Donald Trump. So it's quite mad. I've no idea why I called him Donald Meaning, but anyway, the thing is that so I kind of created this character and I'd seen John Hurt play the main character Crap. in Crap's Last Tapes, but
he was Crap in Crap's Last Tapes.
Yeah, quite, he was indeed. So I kind of so he came here and I basically got to direct him effectively as the character, and he was amazing. He was very, very open, and we kind of set up quite a few microphones around him, and it was like just doing a radio play. And I really like this idea of creating this character. You know, I wanted to do something a bit different, and again, I had no agenda in my head. I just wanted to create something that I was feeling at the time, and so I kind of the character's kind of a bigoted, intransigent old bastard, really, who's kind of like sitting there kind of mumbling to himself and kind of, you know, sitting in his flat somewhere, just kind of like he's broken down every relationship you know, he's ever had with his daughter, with his wife. I kind of created a whole backstory in my head. And all he's got is this tape. It could be from his wife, it could be from a daughter, it could be from his girlfriend, it could be, you know, but it's from a woman who wants to really bring him back to a softer version of himself because he's hardened over the years. And she sends him this music and he's kind of listening to it and he softens during the course of the
Well, it has got a
listening.
Lovely ending.
It does resolve
beautifully.
Well, that was the idea. And I guess it was kind of also about the power of music and about the it was also, you know, before all of this, you know, there's been, I mean, I won't go into politics, but there's been, as we, you know, have seen over the last few years, there's been a swing to the right globally. That I kind of, in a way, this felt like a it kind of preceded all of that, and I kind of was aware that that was happening at the time. This, and it's kind of
this, you know, I spoke about it earlier. You were saying about it, your music, you don't want your music to be didactic, but nevertheless, do you feel that in the 20 odd years since Beyond Skin, that culture has shifted in a way that's more accepting, that's more multicultural?
In some senses, yes. In other senses, definitely not. I mean, you know, if we look at things that have happened in the last few years under this government in relation to immigration and so on, and perception of refugees and asylum seekers, that's why I was so proud to be with Guy and you know, with Nick and you know, and David on that track because of what it was saying, you know, about valuing human beings.
I think that's one of the reasons that you were the first person that sprang to mind for them, was because you are such a great representative of all that is good about a sort of universal multicultural world.
Oh, that's kind.
I think really, Nitin, I'm sort of focusing on art and music. Specifically. And Asian music within our own British culture.
Yeah, I think things have. Yes, I think there is more of an acceptance of it in one way, but I think some of the promise of the 90s hasn't been realised. I mean, I don't hear enough Asian DJs on radio. I don't hear enough Asian music being played on the mainstream. What's happened is we have, say, the Asian Network and so on. But for me, I've kind of talked about that at times in terms of how it's resourced and so on as a kind of cultural apartheid in a way. And I kind of get frustrated by that because I would like to hear more Asian artists on mainstream radio. And, you know, I remember, I won't say which award it was, but I was talking to some of the representatives of a particular award. And I was saying that, you know, it frustrated me there weren't more Asian acts or artists being kind of nominated. And they said, well, that's just, you know, we just go where the merit is, which kind of angered me because I said, well, when you have endemic kind of issues with racism and when you don't have enough representation, you actually need to make an effort to find those people. And, you know, and so we kind of had conversations about that, which I kind of think went well. And I do think there is a shift in terms of recognition of, you know, the fact that there are so many different influences in this country, you know, in the United Kingdom of different cultures. And I think that's when music's at its best, when we're kind of work. You know, YouTube, for example, is a great leveler. You know, I mean, like people, young people today can actually access music from any part of the world. Mm. And I think, you know, if I want to finesse a bulleria, I'll kind of go to YouTube and find some of the best flamenco players around who can actually take you through different ways of playing a bulleria. And, you know, and that's the case with any kind of type of music you're interested in. So from that point of view, I think it's a lot better now because of the internet, because of the fact that we have access to music from anywhere without having to even get out of our homes, you know. And from that point of view, I think our minds are far more open than they ever have been.
Guy, I'd like to finish off with the story of how you both of you ended up as members of Pink Floyd. because this is bit, that record was amazing, but just take us through how that all happened.
Well, Guy should talk first.
I can tell exactly when I first became aware of it. It was March the 23rd, and that's very easy for me to remember because it was my son's birthday. And I was in Manchester, where he's at uni, I'd gone up to take him out for dinner with some friends, and I got a text from David saying, "Are you around and do you know where Nick is? I want to do something for Ukraine." That's the first I heard of it. And then I went round to the house and had dinner a couple of days later, and David played me this thing, you know, he just from this guy Elixir, who I remember him playing with back in 2015. It was interesting because he'd been in trouble with the Russian authorities before, Boombox had. And in fact, he didn't play at the show at Coco's that David played at because he had trouble with his visa. But it was a load of Ukrainian and Belarusian bands who'd been in trouble with the Russian authorities. There's been a long-running thing there. So that's how David knew him. But then he just came across... But then it was coincidence. He saw that video on YouTube of him singing Hey, Hey, Rise Up in that town square. And David was desperate at something because, you know, it's all very real to him. He's got his Ukrainian daughter-in-law and his, you know, half-Ukrainian grandchildren living with him at the house all through lockdown. So it was very real and very visceral. They had a grandmother who was stuck in Ukraine. They were trying to get out. So it was really in his face. And so he had that idea of doing the track. And then he needed a keyboard player. And then I was just told, it said, "We're getting Nitin Sawhney." And I was like, "Oh my God, that's amazing."
Right, tell us your story.
We just met on that day. So now yours, Nitin.
Well, actually, I met David Gilmour many years ago in Paul McCartney's garden at a party a long time ago. And I remember we really got on very well. And I had a lovely chat with Polly as well. And it was really nice. And I met him a few times after that. And he also came to... a performance I did at the White Cube for one of Anthony Gormley's exhibitions as well. And so we'd always got on well, but I hadn't really stayed in touch for quite a long time until Jules Holland's album, and he's featured on one of those tracks. And so I kind of got to work on one of the tracks, and we had communication over email. And so Paul Loseby, who manages him and also manages Jules, lovely guy. And I kind of, you know, was chatting to him, and he was talking about things to do with Pink Floyd. And then out of the blue, David Gilmour calls me up and says, "Look, do you?" It was quite funny because the way he put it was, he said, I could hear him smiling on the other side. He said, "How do you feel about being an official member of the band of Pink Floyd?" I said, "Well, you're such an unsuccessful band. I don't know. I'd have to think about it." It was lovely that he thought of me. I felt really honoured, and I felt very privileged. And they're, you know, obviously great musicians, and it's a very inspiring, you know. It's surreal, though. Again, it's one of many surreal moments I've had in my life, and obviously going over, and I don't think I grasped exactly what was going on until I got there, and I was like, "Oh right," it's because I thought there was going to be loads of musicians probably playing with Pink Floyd, and I'd be one of many, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I actually am." Like, it's just us.
That's the smallest, apart from when we used to do Astronomy Domini live, right. It was just the four of us on stage. Yeah. That was with Rick.
Yeah.
This is the only time I've ever played with Pink Floyd as a four-piece. Amazing. And it's so, like, it's the first time I've played with David and Nick together since 1990, you know.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Whatever, although I've done recording. Let me tell you, as someone who's been around for 35 years, it was special.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful, absolutely wonderful, and actually very easy, and it was a lovely, I thought it was actually a really lovely day, and it was nice. I remember us looking at each other kind of going, "Here we do." I can't remember what but it was like, you know, you were cueing moment.
Because David constructed that song just from a, you know, a free-form vocal.
Yeah.
And he had to retune a lot of it. And it's a fantastic chord structure that he came up with.
It's beautiful. I really like it. No, it's very clever. And that was something I was really impressed by in terms of he must have tempo mapped everything.
Yeah.
But then, and then had to reverse engineer everything. So you'd have to kind of, you know, get the singing, which was just done without anything tuned, and also get it to work with a click track. Yeah. And I kind of thought that was fantastic the way he did it.
Yeah, because he said, what happens with the vocal? Mm. And because I gave the comparison, it's exactly the same as when you write on unlined paper.
Mm.
You know how you veer down.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Said, that's exactly what happens with solo vocals. Is it just gradually tunes down?
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right.
Your involvement seemed perfect, really, because here's, you know, a very Western sounding band mixing music with Eastern European folk music. What's next for you? There's so much. I just want to ask a really simple question here, because this is, you terrify me, Nitin, in that your the capacity to work in different forms at multiple times is, it makes me feel so inadequate, but inspired in totally one. Reading about your journey in the last 2 days, I've become so inspired by you. In that you know what you can achieve and what you shouldn't be frightened of. Just talk me through a little bit of how you balance all those projects that are going on in your life.
Well, first of all, I've got fantastic teams of people who I work with. You know, I've got Tina Arena, who's worked as my PA for.
She's not the Australian singer. Now. By the way.
Not the Australian. She it was identity theft. She just nicked her name, and literally, I mean, she actually met her at Sony years ago and just said, "I like her name," and just changed her name to us, which I found really funny. and that's brilliant, isn't it? By the way, I'm David Gilmour now.
Oh, yeah,
right.
I'm Mr. T.
but then also Harry, who you saw earlier on, who's engineered with me for a number of years. Yeah, fantastic teams, but all, and you know, and obviously live and so on. You guys know that there's so many people you work with who do so much work. But also, I kind of think she's fantastic. Tina's fantastic at sorting out time and scheduling. But I love the way I work now because I get to work in so many different ways and it all cross fertilizes. You know, one moment I'll be working on like I'm doing a one man show. I'll have guests on it as well at Wigmore Hall later this month on the 23rd of July.
Oh.
We've got, you know, and that's a lovely thing to prepare for because that's me just literally talking to an audience, but then playing bits of music in between and so on. And then, you know, I'll be, you know, working at the moment. I'm working on the Nancy Boys, which is a series for Amazon that Neil Gaiman wrote, who did Good Omens and so on. It's brilliant. And I'm working on another series as well. So I'm constantly doing that. And then some film scores that I'm also engaging with. So I'm doing all of that. But then I've got my new album that I'm going to do with Sony Masterworks that I'm kind of coming up with ideas for at the moment. There's so many different things.
Do you get
things,
yourself in like, a mess, though? Do you ever get yourself in like, oh, my God, I've got to finish that thing for this producer? And it's...
You know what it is? It's like conversations. I mean, we're having this conversation now. You'll go and have a conversation with someone else. And, you know, what we've said to each other won't have any, you know, won't have impacted or slowed you down in terms of the conversation you have about something totally different, you know. And so having said that, it might inform something you might say because I might remember something Gary said or Guy said and I'll think, oh, yeah, actually, I remember that. And it's the same kind of thing, I think. You know, it's like if you're working lots of different ways, I find for me it's the most pleasing. I mean, writing for orchestras, I absolutely love doing that. You know, and conducting the London Symphony Orchestra years ago with a score that I'd written was one of my highlights. You know, was actually to do that for me. You know, with a 1.5 hour piece of music really that I'd scored for a Hitchcock silent movie. You know,
yeah.
At the Barbican.
Yeah.
That for me was a serious challenge because I had to train with some people from the Royal Academy for ages and then. I had to in terms of conducting, but you know, I mean, but it's brilliant. They're all challenges that you rise to because you're thrown in the deep end, and I love that. I love being thrown in the deep end, really. So,
well, is delegation not a key talent here?
Delegation is definitely a big thing. You know, you need to do that. You need to know when to do it. And
yeah.
But I mean, you know, for example, with orchestration, Ennio Morricone said he orchestrated his own work because of the fact that he thought his identity was hidden. you know, some of his identity would be in the way that he orchestrates. So I try to do that as well. I orchestrate my own material. But then, you know, when you need to, you know, if, for example, you're working on multiple things at a time, you might bring in somebody to kind of just, you know, copiers to kind of help you get things done at a faster rate. But, you know,
Morricone, though, when he did music for films, his music was inspired by the amount of cloth that he was allowed to have. So, if he couldn't afford an orchestra, then his inspiration would be the smaller. The trouble is nowadays, everyone wants the most out because you can get it all on a synthesizer or you can get it all on samples. So do you try and ever restrict yourself as far as, you know, or inspired by the budget?
Exactly all of that. I mean, you're absolutely right. Ennio Morricone, you know, he used avant-garde kind of musicians, for example, with the spaghetti westerns because they wouldn't actually give him the budget for an orchestra. But, you know, what was fantastic was it created those incredible scores as a result. Mm-hmm. But you know, having said that, you know, I think what I was saying earlier on about creating vocabulary or palettes to work with, I mean, you know, it's with certain TV series or something like that, you might say, actually, we want this to be influenced by tango, you know, because it's a flirtatious thing between two people. And so, you know, it'd be great to get some elements of that in. And then we'll kind of think about how we do that in a way that's not going to feel too obvious, but it's going to kind of create flavors of that. Or we might, you know, it's kind of like you discuss the vocabulary and then you find and discover the vocabulary and try to figure out how to kind of make that work. And so I think that's a beautiful discovery. I love scoring for film and TV for those reasons, because it's always a different vocabulary every time.
Yeah.
And you are restricting yourself according to the themes and the ideas of what you want to do, because it'd be very dull if every single score was just pure orchestra. Orchestras all sound great, but, you know, they don't give enough identity to necessarily the characters.
I did the score for a TV series, well, two TV series back in the 90s, and they wanted, and I had this whole idea for it. When I went up for the first meeting, they said, we want salsa, we want Cuban music.
Mm.
And I found out, I worked out that it was, just through someone I knew, it was actually cheaper to fly to Cuba and use amazing Cuban musicians and do this whole thing legitimately than it was to use the kind of wedding band players that you would find in London.
Yeah.
And it
was
also the most magical thing you can ever do.
Yeah, so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've done that as well. I've gone to, gone over to India or gone over to different places to find musicians. But sometimes you can find some great musicians, you know, around you in London.
Yeah,
there are brilliant Cuban musicians, and there is also brilliant musicians from Africa and all kinds of places that you can kind of bring in. Luckily, I've got a good network of people who actually can put me in touch with certain people, and I also know a lot of great musicians from all over the place, thankfully. So, you know, it's great. And also nowadays you've got bloody Zoom as well, so, you know, like, for example, right. I did the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. I mean, I did it this year, but I also did it last year we had to do it on Zoom because lockdown. So I did it with Ashwin Srinivasan in India, and just me on the piano and the guitar, and or it's just on the piano actually with that one, and we did the whole thing as a duo.
Isn't there a lag?
Yeah. So what I did was he recorded himself. So when I say Zoom, it was in the broadcast of it, in the streaming
of it. Right,
but what was great on the first day of lockdown, I taught myself how to use Final Cut. And so that I could do this, so that I could cut together, sort of different performances with different musicians. So that was really handy. And him being in India and playing bansuri with me playing in my house was really nice. But, you know, to do it split screen and do it in real time, as in what I did was I sent him the parts. There were a couple of things which he sent me, and then I put that together so that we were working with the click, and then literally it was very easy to kind of, you know, to look like we're jamming off each other and so on.
Nitin, it's been a total pleasure having you on Rock on Tours.
Really? Yeah,
we've kept you too long.
I hope this conversation, you know, we can continue privately for many years to come, because it's been
great. Would love to.
Yeah.
Well, really same to you both. Yeah, and it's great to see you both. And yeah, I mean, we need to all meet up for a drink or something like that.
I feel really inspired and kind of woken up by this.
Yeah. Well, that's really, lovely, really from two brilliant musicians like you guys. So that's very nice.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah. All see you later. Cheers.
All right, mate. Bye. All the very, very best to you. Cheers, mate.
Oh, what an intelligent, wonderful spirit that man is.
Yeah, fantastic. But it's just an absolute force for good in the world and the arts. I mean, just, you know, everything he does is great.
And I hope we've...
Fantastic humility. I love that.
Those stories he told.
I hope we've inspired people to go off and listen to some of his wonderful music.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it, and it's great. It's really, really rewarding. And it'll take you to all sorts of other places as well, you know, because there's all the people he collaborates with.
Absolutely. All right, Guy, we have got one more before Raconteurs to record before we finally hit the shores of Blighty.
Yep, and then maybe have a little bit of a holiday.
Yes, I think so. So all the best. Thank you for listening. It's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.